When I was at Oxford in the late 50s and early 60s, I started life as at least partly, a philosopher, and I ended up as a physicist. And one of the things that really struck me at that time was the fact that basically it was regarded as completely beneath the dignity of the professional philosophers to take any interest in the actual details of physics. And conversely, the physicists were completely uninterested, or most of them were completely uninterested in the foundations of the subject. Well, one of the happiest, from my point of view, one of the happiest intellectual developments of my lifetime has been the tremendous extent to which this has changed, as many people in this audience have already testified. Nowadays, it's no longer disreputable to think about fundamental physics in departments of philosophy. It's no longer disreputable for practicing physicists to think about the philosophical implications of what they do. And Aetna has been very much the leader in this effort and the doyen of this whole community. And quite apart from purely intellectual aspects, I think he's also shaped the ethos of this field to a very large extent. So I think it's at least in large measure due to Aetna that while we may all hold strong opinions, and some of us hold very strong opinions indeed, at least we don't spill blood over the body of Schrödinger's cat. So thank you, Aetna. As we, I think most of us are aware, traditionally there have been two major conceptual paradoxes in the foundations of physics. One, the EPR-Bell paradox, has to do with locality. The other one, the Schrödinger's cat paradox, has to do with the realization of specific outcomes. As you all know, Aetna and his collaborators showed us that the EPR-Bell paradox, the non-locality paradox, need not be a matter of metaphysics. You could actually make it a matter of experiment. And partly inspired by this, for the last 25 years, I've been trying to do something roughly similar for the Schrödinger's cat paradox. And what I'd like to do in this talk is to just give you a sort of status report on the progress of this operation. Now, I suspect many of you will have seen parts of this talk before, you've even seen some of my view briefs before, but I do hope to have enough new material that you won't be completely bored by it. So, let me skip the preliminaries and assume that all of you in this audience are aware that at least some people think that there is a quantum measurement paradox. You may not believe it, but at least there's a substantial body of opinion which believes it. And I won't go through the obvious specification of what the paradox is. I'm sure you'll know. But let me just present to you a table which is something rather similar to what Jeffrey Hellman gave us earlier this morning as to the possible approaches to this paradox. So basically, at the start, we have to decide, have to make a decision, whether we really think that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the world, or whether something else comes in at some stage, something which is not describable by our current formalism, it's totally different. Let's suppose first that we do believe that. Is there a blackboard pointer anyway? Some laser pointer or anything of the kind? I can perhaps use one. Yeah. Okay. On the screen? Yeah, okay, fine, that should do. Yeah, that should do. That's fine. Thanks, yeah. Okay, so let's first assume then that we do assume that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the world at both the microscopic and the macroscopic levels. And then there's really, I think, the fundamental question which we have to answer and which various interpretations of quantum mechanics answer in different ways is, do the probability amplitudes which appear in the formalism of quantum mechanics actually correspond to anything out there in the real world? And I think by and large, one can classify interpretations of quantum mechanics by the answers they give to this question at the microscopic level and at the macroscopic level. Crudely speaking, at one extreme, you have the statistical interpretation, or as some people would prefer to call it, the quantum information theoretic interpretation, which says, no, the whole thing is really just a calculus. The amplitudes don't correspond to anything at the microscopic level, still less at the macroscopic level. At the other extreme, you have the relative state or many worlds interpretation, which says, yes, take the amplitude seriously as describing something in the real world at both the microscopic and even at the macroscopic level. And finally, you've got what I call the orthodox or decoherence interpretation, which tries to have its cake and eat it. It tries to say, yes, they do correspond to something physical at the microscopic level, but somehow by the time we get to the macroscopic level, that meaning has disappeared and definite outcomes are always realized. And you're all familiar, I think, with the standard decoherence argument on that, and I hope I don't have to convince too many people in this audience that the decoherence argument is a complete logical non sequitur. What it basically does is to go from the fact that the evidence for the interpretation, which we would use at the microscopic level, has gone away, to jump from there to the conclusion that you can change your complete interpretation of the meaning of the formalism. And I'd be very, obviously very happy to discuss that further with anyone who still feels otherwise, but personally I feel that the decoherence argument is a complete, it just leaves a glaring logical lacuna. So, those are possible approaches if you believe that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the world. And for various reasons, which again I could go into, I don't feel that any one of those approaches is totally comfortable or satisfactory. So we, if we feel like that, we're motivated to consider the alternative, namely that quantum mechanics is not the complete truth about the world, but that by the time we've got from the level of atoms to the level of our own consciousness, somewhere along the line, other non-quantum mechanical principles enter. And they enter in such a way that superpositions of macroscopically distinct states, and I'll come back to that phrase in a moment, superpositions of macroscopically distinct states don't necessarily exist in nature, even when the quantum formalism extrapolated would say they do. And one of the best developed example of this, as many of you know, is the GRWP formalism, which I guess Philip is going to be talking about later. I won't commit myself to that or any other specific mechanism of realization, but I'll just try to consider the whole class of theories which I call macro-realistic, which have this property that by the time I get from the level of the atom up to the level of my own consciousness, then definite outcomes are realized in an objective and physical way by some mechanism which is not quantum mechanics, but has to go beyond quantum mechanics. Well, we're going to ask the question, can we actually decide this question experimentally? Before I get into the nitty-gritty, let me just, as a preliminary, to get it out of the way, talk about one issue which people sometimes raise in this context, which is whether the EPR Bell experiments already rule out a physical collapse mechanism of the kind I've described. Again, I'm going to talk about this in very generic terms, not with reference to any particular model. Fairly obviously, if you decide that an event is realized, a definite outcome is realized when a photon of an EPR pair passes or fails to pass a polarizer, or even when it gets into the anode of a photomultiplier, if you take that point of view, then it's fairly obvious that you can't have a physical collapse mechanism without violating locality. However, there's a let out there, which I think a number of people probably have been conscious of, but Adrian Kent has discussed this very explicitly in a recent paper, which is simply the fact that you don't necessarily have to decide that an event takes place when the photon passes the polarizer, when it enters the anode of the photomultiplier. Perhaps even you don't have to decide an event takes place when a current is produced from the cathode. I think it's the cathode, isn't it, of the photomultiplier. In fact, you can actually decide to leave the realization of a definite event to a pretty late stage. Let's imagine, for example, that you have the sort of setup which I guess the Geneva group has realized, where you have actually 10 kilometers between your detection station. Well, That corresponds to a time of, I'll do it in my head, something of the order of a few microseconds, I guess. And that's still lots and lots still a relatively short time, and you can afford to have the collapse after that, so that there is time for the signals to actually reach one station from another. And so if you were to do that, at first sight at least, you would be able to have a collapse mechanism which nevertheless respected locality. Why do I emphasize this, respecting locality? Well, the whole aim of a realization mechanism is to attribute a physical sense, is to say that the physical amplitudes represent something in the real world. So you can't, as it were, collapse your wave function at one detector station, still have unwanted bits left over at the other station. So you do have, if you're going to take this kind of view, then you do have to leave adequate time for information to be transmitted subliminally from one station to the other. So at first sight, at least, you could afford to leave the realization very late indeed. You would even afford to leave it until you've actually correlated your two signals from your two detection stations, brought them back to some central coincidence counter, and read off the result. And of course, at that point, there was no question of spatial non-locality. Now, it's true, of course, that in recent experiments, very often the data have been taken at the two detection stations and kept there, stored there, sometimes for hours or days before they're actually correlated. But no one has ever done an experiment in which you actually have two human observers sitting here and here. So you don't know for sure that the collapse did not take place even later than that, though it seems very improbable, I have to say. So that, at first sight, is something which will get you out of any violation of locality with a physical collapse mechanism. However, there's a point which I've never seen actually discussed, though again it may have been, I suspect people may have been conscious of it. That's what I call the third party effects. So long as the system is isolated, that mechanism works fine. But you have to remember that when a detector fires and eventually prints out some kind of computer printout with the result and eventually funnels those results down to a coincidence counter, what you have to remember is that lots of other things also are happening at the detector at that point, which are correlated, of course, to the output. And quite a few of those events are liable to involve photons, which will then go away at the speed of light. You will never now be able to recover those. So you're going to get, as it were, unwanted bits of wave function left over, whether you like it or not. So it seems to me that in a local macro-realistic theory, third-party correlations must automatically be different from those predicted by quantum mechanics. Did that worry us? Well, I don't think it need worry us right now, at least, because, at least as far as I know, we have absolutely no evidence that quantum mechanics does predict the right correlations regarding these third-party photons and whatever. But this just shows that there's a considerable interaction between the, if you like, the EPR paradox and the Schrödinger's cat paradox in this kind of respect. That was more or less a digression. Let's go on to my main theme now. We said we had these two hypotheses, one of them being quite simply that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the world, and the other being that something else comes in at some kind of relatively macroscopic level. And so the question we'd like to now raise is it possible to discriminate experimentally between these two classes of hypotheses? Now, obviously, you could ask that question at a definite level of macroscopicness. So let's suppose that that's something we've defined by a particular experiment and so forth. What must we do to distinguish these two hypotheses? Well, I think it's fairly obvious that if, as used to be supposed, was supposed by a great many people, I should say, right up to about the year 2000, if it's true that decoherence is going to come in the moment we try to generate superpositions of macroscopically distinct states, then what that says is that all predictions of a theory in which one outcome or the other has been realized are going to be exactly identical to those which we would get from the standard application of quantum mechanics with the measurement axiom at the last stage. Right? So if we're going to get anything useful, if we're going to make a useful discrimination between quantum mechanics and macro-realism, what we have to do is to be able to observe quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. And this immediately, of course, raises the question, what's an appropriate measure of the macroscopicness, or if you like, the Schrodinger's cattiness, of a particular quantum superposition? Well, I mean, I think I'll argue till the cows come home about this issue, and I think it is really a matter of definition. The only constraint I would like to put on the definition, is that you should not make the non-existence of quantum interference and macroscopically distinct states a tautology. Unfortunately, there has been a tendency in some of the quantum measurement literature to say, we confidently predict you will never see quantum interference between macroscopically distinct states. And then we go away and do an experiment, say with using squids and so forth, and the people come back and say, oh well, the mere fact that you saw quantum interference proves that the states could not have been macroscopically distinct. Well, you know, what does one say? I can't really argue with that kind of point of view. So I don't think one wants to make that kind of definition. Now, I have a couple of proposed measures of macroscopic distinctness, but they're not sacrosanct, but I'll just put them forward since they form basis for discussion, at least. First of all, in the two states in question, the difference in the expectation value of one or more extensive physical quantity in the two branches should be larger than, say, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 9th, you name it, in atomic units. And let's call that that ratio, the ratio of this difference to the in atomic units, lambda. Now, that's a good start, but I think it's probably not sufficient, because if you really were to take that seriously, well, let's think about the neutron interferometer, for example. In the neutron interferometer, you can easily have beams which are different by something of the order of a meter. Now, a meter in terms of atomic units, and angstrom is something like 10 to the 10. Do you call that a superposition of macroscopically distinct states? Well, I mean, again, it's a matter of definition, but I don't think it's particularly useful in this context to call it that. So we want something else. And what we, the other criterion which I gave way back in 1980 and still somewhat like, is the degree of what I call then disconnectivity. Disconnectivity is, in a sense, a sort of crude forerunner of modern ideas about many particle entanglement, I think. What it basically asks is how many elementary objects are behaving appreciably differently in the two branches of the superposition. That again, if it's going to be macroscopically distinct, that number should be large. So, I mean, for example, if I'm just thinking about, say, superfluid helium or a laser, that number is only about one. If I'm thinking about Schrodinger's real-life cat, then it's something like 10 to the 30th. So it is a big difference. And I would like to put some emphasis on that. Let me just skip this for a moment. I'll come back to this point. When we put these two criteria together, it naturally leads to the concept of a macroscopic variable. I think probably that doesn't need much explanation. It's a variable such that interestingly different values of the variable correspond to roughly macroscopically distinct states. A typical example, which we'll come back to, is the circulating current in a squid ring, say. Where the energy turns out to have a rather interesting dependence on the value of the current. And these two states are both relevant, and they correspond to, well, as we'll see, macroscopically distinct values. But let me, at this point, just address briefly an objection which was raised to this whole program at a fairly early stage. People say, well, you know, this idea of multiparticle entanglement, disconnectivity, as I've called it, that you've introduced, surely that's nothing at all exotic. Surely we have this already in many existing experiments. And the kinds of situation which were quoted in that context had to do with, for example, things like QED cavities or Cooper pair boxes. Suppose we have a QED cavity, and forget about the atoms, we won't put any atoms in for the moment, we may either have a photon or no photon in that cavity, or we would normally say we might have a superposition of the vacuum and a state containing one photon. Well, come to think of it, that's a bit naive. Why is the photon contained in the cavity? Only because the walls reflected it pretty well perfectly. Why did the walls reflect it? Well, because the electric field of the photon drove the electrons in the walls and they responded to it. And therefore, it's very tempting to think that, well, in fact, it's correct to think that the correct description of the universe should be one in which the state of the electromagnetic field in the cavity is entangled with the states of the electrons in the walls. So when the when there's a vacuum, the electrons are behaving one way. When there's a photon there, the electrons are behaving another way. And so that's fine. I mean, so far, so good. But then the tendency has been to say, well, it's obvious, since the electrons are doing very different things in these two states, those two states, E1 and E2, must be pretty much orthogonal. Not true, it turns out. Not at all true. You can actually do the calculation explicitly, and you find that the ratio, that the difference of this from 1, is only an incredibly small factor. It's basically the ratio of the London penetration depth to the wavelength of the wave multiplied by the frequency of the wave divided by the plasma frequency squared, which is, in all practical cases, a very, very small number. So surprisingly, the states of the electron in the walls are practically identical, depending whether you have a photon there or not. Second example, which people sometimes, sometimes like to reduce in this context, is the Cooper pair box. In a Cooper pair box, you've got a large reservoir here containing many Cooper pairs, and then you have a smaller box here, and the states you're interested in, for quantum computing purposes or whatever, are ones, there are two states, one of which you have n particles in the reservoir and no extra particles in the box, and then a state in which you have n minus 2 in the reservoir and an extra Cooper pair in the box. So far, so good, but then people say, wait a moment. When that Cooper pair jumped from the reservoir into the box, there are 10 to the 9 electrons in here, surely they must recoil violently. So again, you have to write, at the first side, an entangled state effect, where E1 and E2 are now different states of the other 10 to the 9 electrons in the box. So again, the crucial question is, how different is this overlap from unity? And again, quite surprisingly at first side, the answer is hardly at all. It turns out for any reasonable parameter values, this figure is only of the order of 10 to the minus 6. Sorry, 1 minus 10 to the minus 6. So basically, in neither of these cases is your microscopic quantum mechanical system entangled with its environment. And indeed, that's just as well if you come to think of it, because if it were entangled with the environment, application of the standard textbook quantum mechanics shouldn't work. So that's not an objection. So we can try to pursue this program then, and we can do it in three stages. The first stage would be to do circumstantial tests of the applicability of quantum mechanics to macroscopic variables. The second stage would be the observation or not of QIMDS, remember that was quantum interference in macroscopically distinct states, given that you make a quantum mechanical interpretation of the raw data. Well, that would be fine, and as we'll see, that's been done. But that still doesn't get us to the stage which is attained in the EPR Bell experiments. The final stage, which we'd like to carry out, is to do an experiment which would either, quite independently of the interpretation of the raw data, would either exclude macrorealism or exclude the universal validity of quantum mechanics. In other words, would force nature to choose between macrorealistic theories and quantum mechanics. So this is a program, as I said, which some of us have been pushing for quite a long time now. And initially, it met with rather strong objections, predominantly from the professional quantum measurement community. And the first objection was that if we're dealing with a macro variable, then more or less by definition, the action, that is in technical terms of classical mechanics, the action was very large in units of h-bar, and therefore the predictions of quantum mechanics should be indistinguishable from those of classical mechanics. Well, actually, that statement is not quite true, but even if it were, it wouldn't be a worry, because all one need do, in fact, is to find a macroscopic variable whose motion is nevertheless controlled by an energy which is itself on the microscopic scale. And as we'll see, there are quite a lot of those about, as it turns out. The second is the second objection is that stage two is impossible in practice because you will never see, quote, you will never see quantum interference between macroscopically distinct states because the coherence will come in and kill you stone dead. And I'm told that when some of the experiments on squids I was I'm going to be talking about were being set up and planned in the late 90s, one or two very distinguished people from this community simply asserted flat out these would just never work. Well, as we'll see, they worked, so that's not a worry. The third objection, I think, is in some sense the most worrying, really. Suppose we do these experiments, suppose we go to stage two, say, and suppose we do observe quantum interference when we expected to. Well, no one's going to make a big deal out of that. Suppose we don't observe quantum interference when we expected to. Well, then the obvious objection is you didn't observe interference simply because you left out some mechanism of decoherence, which is actually there in real life. So you've got to be able to exclude that before you can draw any negative consequences. How are we going to deal with that objection? This is a bit tricky, actually. If we were dealing with something like quantum optics or elementary particle physics or atomic physics, then our natural tendency would be to say, well, we know the basic Hamiltonian, it's just a matter of writing it down and calculating with it. We're not, unfortunately. We're dealing with messy, solid-state condensed matter systems. Have a chunk of metal which is sitting on a lab bench. We don't know the exact chemical composition in minute detail of the metal. We don't know where the various dislocations are. We don't know how the exactly how it's fitting onto the lab bench. There are vibrations in the lab bench. There are black body radiation all over the place. It's a mess. How are we going to deal with that? Well, here's one possible technique for dealing with it. If we were traditionally, we'd follow the green arrows, as it were. That is, what we would do is we'd write down what we think is the best microscopic Hamiltonian, and from that we would derive the quantum mechanical behavior and perhaps as a limit, classical behavior. And so that way is not available to us in this case because we don't know the microscopic Hamiltonian in minute detail. Let's envisage the possibility of going the other way around. Let's imagine we can start from the classical behavior and from that infer enough about the microscopic Hamiltonian that we can make predictions with fair confidence about the quantum behavior. Rather serendipitously, it turns out that actually turns out to be possible in many, many, many practical cases. And we can actually test whether it's possible or not by applying, you might think in some sense this argument is circular. I think on second thought you'll find it isn't. But we can actually test out this argument by trying to calculate things using this technique and then comparing them with the experimental data. And in fact, this has been done over the last 20 years with some success, particularly on Josephson junctions and squibs. For example, one has considered the probability of tunneling of a system out of a metastable well. The variable in this case is the circulating current or trapped flux in the squid. We can consider the resonant tunneling or level quantization and various other things along these general lines. And we can compare the results of our calculation using this technique with experiment. And it does actually work fairly impressively, I think one can say. What these experiments at this level, this is basically stage one. What we're doing is to test the conjunction of two hypotheses. First, that we can legitimately apply quantum mechanics to the motion of collective macroscopic variables, something which is not entirely obvious a priori. And secondly, that the technique of actually doing quantitative calculations using this, this method does work. And indeed, the result does seem to be that it does. So basically, we've done stage one, and that seems to have worked fine. Quantum mechanics does appear to be working rather well for these macroscopic variables. So let's go on to stage two, which was explicitly the search for quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. And there have been a number of experiments over the last 5 or 6 years along these lines, and some of them are much better talked about by other people in this room, I think, than me, but let me just mention them at least. The most direct extension of the traditional Young-Slitz experiments done with atoms or electrons has, of course, been the work of Anton Zeilinger and his group in Vienna on the diffraction of complex molecules such as fullerenes and so forth. So these are basically a standard Young-Slitz experiment. They've got very nice results. They've seen diffraction, seen interference rather nicely. There are a couple of things which are rather amusing, I think, about this experiment. When I first heard about this, I thought, look, this clearly isn't going to work without some kind of monochromator or collimator. And the answer is it does work for various technical reasons. It seems to work fine even without a monochromator. And the second thing, which is even more amusing, I think, is that the temperature, typically in these experiments, of the order of several hundred degrees, and so many internal vibrational modes are excited. And some of those modes actually couple to the radiation field. So you think, wait a minute, that means the radiation field can tell whether I've gone, a given atom has gone through, a molecule has gone through this slit or this slit. Ha, you fool it, you can't. Turns out that the wavelength of the associated photons is so long that it can't distinguish these two slits. So the experiment still works. It's very, very beautiful, I think. A second area in which this is actually the earliest experiment, which historically claimed evidence for quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states, are the experiments on magnetic biomolecules. The molecule in question is horse spleen ferritin, which is a molecule of biological significance, which contains a core of about 5,000 iron ions, which can be ordered either all parallel up or all parallel down. And these are surrounded by some kind of inorganic, kind of an organic sheath here. And so the idea is that you look for evidence of superposition of these states in which 5,000 atoms are simultaneously up and one in which 5,000 are simultaneously down. And the way you do this is by resonance absorption of the RF field or the noise. If you buy the interpretation of that experiment given by its authors, then you have seen interference of macroscopically distinct states with a D value. Remember, D was the number of particles which is behaving differently in the two states, about 5,000 or so. Notice, incidentally, that this is an experiment on an ensemble of these molecules, not on a single molecule. So you're just doing the ensemble average of the behavior of all your molecules. A third system, which is actually a third experiment, which is very interesting in its own right. It wasn't done for this reason. It was done more because of concerns with locality. So the authors group in 2001, they actually did an EPR build type correlation experiment between two macroscopic bodies of cesium gas. And they basically produced results which could not be explained by any local theory. Now, as I say, they were more interested in the EPR aspect of this, but it can be interpreted as an experiment on interference of macroscopically distinct states. But if you do, you find that the D value there goes as n to the half, not n. And in fact, the authors themselves comment this is not in some sense a genuine Schrodinger's cat type experiment. The numbers are still quite substantial. They're still about 10 to the sixth here. The workhorse, though, in this area has been Josephson circuits of one type or another. And the basic Josephson circuit in which we're most interested is one in which we have a single superconducting ring interrupted with a single Josephson junction. And under certain conditions, if you apply the right amount of external magnetic flux, then it turns out that there are two degenerate ground states corresponding to circulation of the supercurrent in either clockwise or anticlockwise. And typical values of the circulating current, something of the order of 1 microamp. Now, one possible reaction to this, of course, is to say, huh, 1 microamp, what's the big deal? After all, the circulating current in the p state of the hydrogen atom is something like a milliamp. So much larger. However, there is a crucial difference here. That 1 microamp is being carried by something like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 electrons here. So we really do, at prima facie at least, we have a rather high value of disconnectivity in this experiment. I'll come back to that point. So what one is basically looking for, crudely speaking, is evidence of superposition of these, not just a mixture, but a superposition of these clockwise and anticlockwise circulating states. And the original experiments were done at Stony Brook and Delft in 2000, and they were spectroscopic in nature. They basically looked for the evidence of this kind of superposition in the avoided crossing of the energy levels, and sure enough, they did find it. In more recent years, in the last 3 or 4 years, I mean, some much more direct experiments which have actually looked at real-time oscillations between these states. And the technical name is Ramsey Fringe experiments. And they have actually found it rather spectacularly. And let me just this probably doesn't mean very much if I just flash it on and off, but let me just show you a typical example of the data from the Delft group here. This is a Ramsey fringe interference pattern. And let me emphasize that the number of peaks which you see here is not the Q factor. The Q factor for this experiment is much, much larger than this. It's something like 350. So what that says is you can start your system, in the, crudely speaking, you can start it in a clockwise state, and then observe it coherently oscillating backwards and forwards between clockwise and anticlockwise for up to something like 350 oscillations. And I've even heard rumors that they're now considerably improved on that result, but I don't know for sure. So this is actually rather spectacular evidence that if you interpret the raw data in quantum mechanical terms, then what was occurring at intermediate stages in this experiment was not a mixture, but a superposition of these two macroscopically distinct quantum states. So how do the numbers look at this stage in the game? Let's just think of a few typical systems and plot the results in terms of these two characteristic criteria which are used for macroscopic distinctness. One is the extensive difference, the extent to which extensive quantities were different in atomic units in the two states, and the other is this disconnectivity or entanglement, the extent to which large numbers of microscopic particles are behaving differently in the two states. Well, if you just look at the at a single electron, of course, both those numbers are rather boringly just one. A neutron interferometer, this number is large, but this one is one because you've only got one neutron there at a time, basically. A QED cavity, these are experiments of Arosh's group in Paris. They're not directly related to what I was saying earlier about QED cavities. They've done some very nice experiments where both these numbers are about 10. They have some very beautiful aspects, but it's still only about 10. The Cooper pair box, again, this number is large, but for the reason I discussed earlier, the disconnectivity is still only microscopic. Now we come to the more genuinely macroscopic superposition experiments. In the Fullerene experiments, both these numbers are of the order of 1,000 or so. Ferritin experiments, if you interpret them as the authors do, then about 5,000. And the Ortus quantum optics experiment, something like 10 to the 6th for both these numbers. And finally, the Guinness Book of Records is held by the SUNY SQUID experiment, at least as regards this column. The magnetic moment, if I'm allowed to count that as a decent extensive quantity, I guess, the magnetic moment by which the two states differ is something of the order of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 Bohr megatons. So that number really is rather large. What about the disconnectivity? I'll just come back to that in a moment. For comparison, the smallest visible dust particle has a number about 10 to the 22 here and 10 to the 16 here. And Schrödinger's real-life cat sitting up mewing in her box has about 10 to the 34 here and 10 to the 25 here. So optimistically, we're how far are we along? On a logarithmic scale, 30, well, depending on what this figure turns out to be, but somewhere around 30 to 40% of the way from the atom to a real-life Schrödinger's cat. You may or may not think that's impressive, but compare it with what it was, say, 10 years ago, and you'll find that that number is growing by orders of magnitude. So I think we really have got, thanks to experimental ingenuity of my colleagues, we've got a long way in this particular direction. Let me just briefly return to a point which is perhaps of slightly technical interest. It has to do with what exactly is the disconnectivity of the flux qubit experiment, and I'll take the SUNY Stony Brook one, which is the most spectacular from this point of view. Well, your two states in this case correspond to current circulating anticlockwise or current circulating clockwise. These are your two qubit basis states, if you like. Incidentally, I should say that it was a great bit of serendipity that quantum computing, or the prospect of quantum computing, came up when it did, because basically this whole program of testing for quantum interference in macroscopically distinct states has simply piggybacked on the desire to build a quantum computer. So we're very lucky in that respect. Anyway, so how many electrons are behaving differently in the two states? Well, of course, to a large extent, that's a matter of definition, but I think one can make the following remarks. You can ask how many of how many single electrons would you have to change the state appreciably to get from one state to from one of these two macroscopic states to the other? Now if the current was being carried by a normal metal, then it turns out that in this case you just have the thermosphere moving this way, and in this case the thermosphere is moving this way. So all you've got to do is to displace the electrons which are sitting here over to here. How many of those electrons are there? Well, about I divided by E times the Fermi velocity. That's not that large a number. It's 10 to the 4, 10 to the minus 5 in the SUNY experiments. Suppose next that you actually, these electrons are actually forming tightly bound diatomic molecules. And in that so in one case, they're all moving one way. In the other case, they're moving the other way. In that case, I think it's almost immediately intuitively obvious that the disconnectivity is simply half the number of particles. It's the number of molecules, basically. So in that case, it's very large. Now, in real life, you've got a situation which is somewhat intermediate in this respect. Most of your electrons are buried way down in the Fermi C, and in some sense, the action is coming from the Cooper pairs, which is sitting near the Fermi surface. So, although I haven't formulated a rigorous definition here or worked it out exactly, this is an intuitive argument. I believe that the sort of intuitively reasonable value for the disconnectivity in this case is the number of Cooper pairs. And the number of Cooper pairs is basically the number of particles divided by the BCS gap divided by the Fermi energy. And that turns out to be something like 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 7th, really, for the SUNY experiment, which still makes it the record holder in this respect, but not quite as impressive as that number of 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10. Okay, so we've now basically completed stage two. We've now verified that if we do indeed interpret the raw data in quantum mechanical terms, then we must conclude that at intermediate stages in these experiments, we did actually have a quantum superposition of these macroscopically distinct states. So the question is, where do we go from here? Well, the most obvious and conservative way to go is simply to try for larger values of these two parameters. Like, for example, try in the diffraction experiments, perhaps we could diffract a virus or something even more, eventually something even more complicated. But I'm not sure that that's, from my point of view, that's the optimum direction to go, because after all, once we're dealing with the center of mass variable, then it's not obvious that it should behave very differently for a virus than it does, say, from a fullerene molecule. So if I could, in fact, do experiments, or if I knew someone like Anton who might be able to do experiments on materials or molecules of biological significance, what I would much rather do is to try to generate superpositions of states of the same molecule with different biological functionality. For example, what we'd love to be able to do very, very, very far away, but in principle, the rhodopsin molecule, which is the first stage of vision in the human eye, is, I believe, triggered by something like half a dozen photons. It's not that difficult these days to generate a superposition of the vacuum and a six photon state. So it'd be lovely to try to see if one could observe the superposition of the triggered and non-triggered states of the rhodopsin molecule. Well, as you can guess, that's going to be very, very hard. To make it really meaningful, you'd have to do it under biologically realistic conditions. And then, well, all the one's prejudices are that decoherence is going to come in and kill you stone dead. However, I don't think we should be too depressed about that, because it's been, at least my experience in the whole history of this subject, that every back-of-envelope attempt to estimate the degree of decoherence in a given physical system has almost without exception ended up grossly overestimating it. Nature is much less decoherent than one is tempted to think by simple arguments. So I don't think it's totally unthinkable that this kind of experiment might be done in the next few decades. So. Again, one might try to look for more, try to test whether the realization takes place when more sophisticated forms of entanglement than the simple kind we've discussed so far are generated. And again, one might look for tests of specific mechanisms, like, say, Penrose's mechanism based on general relativistic considerations. And in fact, Dirk Burmeister at UCSB is right now building an experiment to try to test Penrose's hypothesis about that. As regards GRWP, unfortunately, it turns out that at the present state, the squid experiments don't test GRWP because GRWP does not predict a collapse under those under the circumstances of the current experiments. However, and basically the reason for that is that GRWP, the trigger in GRWP is a large separation of the center of mass in the two branches of the superposition, and that doesn't occur in the squid experiments. However, I believe it may be possible to devise a generalization of these experiments in which, for example, you hang a small magnet above your squid so it's drawn down or pushed up, depending on the squid state, which might perhaps test GRWP, and I actually have a student working on that right now. However, what I think is going to be the most interesting direction to go in the next few years at least, is to exclude macrorealism definitively. Now, let me emphasize again, so far all we've done is to show that if we interpret the raw data in quantum mechanical terms, then we have a superposition and non-mixture of the two states in question. That is not the same as excluding a class of macrorealistic theories, and we would like to be able to do the latter, just as has been done in the case of the Bell's theorem experiments. So let's define a macrorealistic theory by three hypotheses. We have this variable, the circulating flux, clockwise or anticlockwise. We know that whenever we measure it, we get one or the other. That's the experimental fact. So let's assume that at almost all times, whether or not that we observe the circulating current, it has one of these two values. I say almost all because you have to allow for brief transit times, but you can do that. Second hypothesis, postulate is on non-invasive measurability. I should be able to devise an experiment which, classically at least, can detect whether the system is in one state or the other without disturbing it. There are ways of doing that which I could discuss. And the final postulate, which we appear to need, I think, in all cases of this kind, is induction. That is that the states of ensembles are determined by their initial preparation and not by anything that happens later. As it were, no backwards causality in time. Well, since I'm running out of time, I won't go through the argument for this, but there is a really rather simple argument, which Anupam Gurgadai gave some time ago, which shows that given these three postulates, you can actually make a prediction for an experimentally measurable set of two-time correlations, which I'll call K. I won't, unless everyone's particularly interested, I won't define it explicitly, but it's basically the exact analog of the CHSH quantity, which occurs in the CHSH inequality. The only difference is that the polarizer angles are replaced by times. So the possible outcomes of an experiment done on squids in this way, well, the most disappointing outcome is clearly the experiment doesn't work. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you what the punchline was, but I'll just tell you what it is. Just as in CHSH, the punchline is that any macrorealistic theory must satisfy this inequality, and that quantum mechanics, by contrast, predicts this result here. So these are clearly incompatible, just as they are in the Bell's theorem case. So the possible outcomes are, first, that the experiment doesn't work. In other words, there's too much noise and interruption by the environment and so forth, so that it turns out at the end, if you do the quantum mechanical calculation properly, you predict a value less than 2 and therefore not in contradiction with macrorealism. Well, I think that would be rather disappointing, but from the experiments done so far, I think that's rather unlikely, actually, because people seem to have eliminated interruption by the environment or decoherence by the environment to a very large extent in these experiments, much better than one would have thought one could possibly do it. The second possibility is that the experiment is done, and it turns out that K is greater than 2 and close to the prediction of quantum mechanics. And then, of course, a lot of people would say, well, that's not particularly exciting. We all knew that was liable to happen. But I think it would be quite nice. It would have excluded a realistic account of the world, not just at the level of atoms, but right up at the level of squids, where something like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 electrons are cooperating to give you the effect. As I say, it's some way, at least on a logarithmic scale, towards our everyday experience. And, of course, the final possibility is the experiment is done, and that K turns out to be less than 2, and if you really take that result seriously, then what you would say is, well, that shows that quantum mechanics is refuted at the level of squids, and hence a fortiori, presumably at the everyday level. I don't think that's going to happen, actually. I think that when the experiment is actually done, there'll be lots and lots of argument, not merely about the interpretation of the raw data or the experimental complications, but also about whether you really knew enough about the theory to be able to predict unambiguously the quantum mechanical result. And of course, we don't. There are going to be all sorts of loopholes. But hopefully we can eventually plug them. And so if we can do this, then hopefully we will, in some sense, have been able to do at least at the level of squids, not perhaps a very, very dramatic level, but still considerably better than nothing, we will have been able to do at the level of squids for the Schrödinger's cat paradox, the analogue of what Adner and his colleagues managed to do many years ago for the EPR-Bell paradox. So thank you. They might be, yes. There have been suggestions that you could do experiments somewhat similar in spirit to the ones on squids. The advantages are that, you actually have much better control of the details of your microscopic Hamiltonian, which of course always makes the quantum optics people very happy. The disadvantage is that, first of all, people have usually suggested doing this by tomographic means, but if you're dealing with something like 10 to the sixth atoms, then that really seems to be a very, very big operation indeed. And secondly, that these atomic experiments tend to be much less robust in the sense that they're much more vulnerable to small fluctuations in the shape of your potential and so forth. But I think there is some scope for action in that field. Yes. No, because they haven't done the experiment in the way to see that, as it were. You'd have to the conditions to draw that conclusion about macro-realistic theories are very severe, and in particular, you've got to be able to do a non-invasive measurement, and most of their measurements are not non-invasive. Yes. Well, that's a good question. Obviously, quantum mechanics as such, the quantum mechanical formalism makes no distinction between a two-state Hilbert space and a thousand-dimensional Hilbert space. Any more than it makes a distinction between single particle coordinates and collective coordinates. That's not to say that an alternative theory, which eventually supersedes quantum mechanics, may not find that distinction very important. So I think there are all sorts of questions of this type that one can raise, where quantum mechanics, as it were, says, well, you know, no difference, and some other theory might. Yes. Yes, right. Well, I mean, it could be simply that in some sense the system or the system plus its environment or whatever does move into a much higher dimensional Hilbert space, and this makes a difference. I just don't think we know ahead of time. So that's why rather than, as it were, making specific conjectures about how exactly the realization process might take place, I've been interested simply in pushing experiment as far as possible along the Roman axis, just hoping something will turn up. So far it hasn't, and I'm disappointed, but I'll keep trying. Well, that would be. I mean, if you're willing to volunteer for that experiment in 50 years' time or whatever, yes, I think it would be very, very amusing to try to do something like that. As I say, all one's zero-order instincts say that anything which has to do with biological systems or consciousness or whatever is liable to involve so much decoherence that it's going to be unthinkable in the foreseeable future. But as I said, you know, we've always been, it's turned out that in the past we've always been too pessimistic, so who knows. Oh, well, for example, imagine that I could diffract, or I or Anton Zeilinger or someone could actually diffract you through a young slits experiment. And you come out on the other side and we ask you, you know, which slit do you think you went through? And that's, I think, presumably, well, who knows? I mean, all our prejudices are that you say, well, I thought I definitely went through the top slit. I think that kind of, I mean, that's science fiction probably, but in principle, I think that would be very interesting to do. But I mean, quite frankly, my bet would be that by the time we, quite seriously, that by the time we get to the level of technology where that experiment becomes anything more than a joke, as it were, we will almost certainly have found something overtaking quantum mechanics. Something which, well, as I think John Bell said, it'll overtake us in a way that will astonish us and which we simply can't imagine right now. Yes. Correct. Yes. So it's time ensemble. You start the system repeatedly in some initial state. Yes.
It's more like a contextuality experiment in time. So I'm wondering now whether, like, when you go from cosmic vector to valid experiment, to
yes.
single particle experiment to two particle experiment.
Yes. It's entirely possible, and in fact, what is very, again, I think very unexpected, I would have really have bet strongly against this 7 years ago, but in fact the Delft group has actually succeeded in obtaining evidence for entanglement of two flux mode squids, so precisely what you say. And I think one certainly should be starting to think about stronger tests that one can do in this way. So far, I haven't done, as far as I know, most people haven't. Right. Okay. Yep. Right. Okay. Right. Okay. So make some kind of GHC state type state, for example. Yes. No. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Sure. Yes. And in fact, one of the objections which is often raised to the squid experiments as being anything of fundamental interest is precisely that the fact that you've only got these two qubit states of interest is a result of the strong interactions between the particles of the system. And people have indeed suggested, well, why not try to, as it were, take away this aspect? Let's try to do exactly what you said. And I think it would indeed be very interesting. And again, one doesn't know a priori whether quantum mechanics still will work under those conditions. If one could do the experiment, one should. I think, if anything, it would probably improve their usefulness. I mean, I think if one, almost certainly, if one wanted to, as it were, get rid of the macroscopic quantum interference aspects, there are ways to do it. For example, if you pin down your carbon-60 molecule in some kind of crystalline matrix background, hopefully, under many circumstances, that will get rid of the interference aspects. So you can still use it. If what you're going to be actually operating on, as it were, is the electronic states, the internal electronic states of the molecule, you can still do so, just as you would have done in the past with other molecules. However, there might be ways in which you could actually exploit the quantum mechanical aspects to do certain kinds of things which you might not have otherwise been able to do. For example, there was an idea which, as far as I know, hasn't been turned out to be much use from a practical engineering aspect, but there was a nice idea a few years ago that you could actually make a transistor by exploiting certain kinds of quantum interference effect, and that would be a case in point, I think. Well, first of all, I mean, there are, of course, crystalline C60 with a certain doping, with alkali impurities, has been found to be superconducting. In fact, superconducting at quite high temperatures. I think, frankly, whether there are any aspects of that system which make it more useful from a practical engineering point of view is something I wouldn't really be competent to discuss. Let's put it this way. I think I'm correct in saying, here's one possible aspect that might be important. I think I'm correct in saying that it is the highest temperature, the superconductor with the highest known transition temperature, which does not have nodes in its gap. And that alone, I would think, would make it really rather useful from many points of view, for example, for certain applications in communications and so forth. But as I say, I'm not an applied scientist, so I can't give a firm opinion on that.
Yes, I will use that. Yeah, if you want to? Is that take this off to the whole? Oh, is that needed? Okay, I can work on top of it. Okay.